This is Audible.
American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson, by Joseph J. Ellis. Dedication, for Edmund S. Morgan. Preface and Acknowledgement. Any aspiring biographer of Jefferson, recognizing the ink already spilled and the libraries already filled, might do well to recall the young Virginian's famous words of 1776, which is to say that no one should undertake yet another book on Thomas Jefferson for light and transient causes. In fact, prudence dictates, and a decent respect of the opinions of mankind requires, that the publication of all new books about that man from Monticello be accompanied by a formal declaration of the causes that have impelled the author to undertake the effort. My own defense would begin over 30 years ago when I entered graduate school at Yale to study early American history. It is impossible to avoid Jefferson while attempting to master the story of the American Revolution, since his career crisscrosses the major events of the era, and his ideas, or at least the ideas for which he became the most eloquent spokesman, define the central themes of the story of the emerging American Republic. Moreover, I was a native Virginian who, like Jefferson, had graduated from the College of William and Mary. I even had reddish-blonde hair like Jefferson, and had learned how to disguise my insecurities behind a mask of enigmatic silence. It was therefore natural for me, once ensconced in the former cradle of New England Puritanism and Federalism, to identify with Jefferson's edgy doubts about the arrogant austerities and quasi-Arctic climate of New England. My eventual mentor in graduate school, Edmund S. Morgan, even had a huge Jefferson portrait on his office wall, the luminous Rembrandt Peale likeness of 1800, which looked down on our seminar sessions with otherworldly authority that I found oddly reassuring. Jefferson and I were kindred spirits, I told myself, allies in this alien world where a southern accent seemed inversely correlated with one's seriousness of purpose. This youthful infatuation for Jefferson eventually went the way of my southern accent, never completely gone altogether, but relegated to the blurry margins, where it lost its distinctive character. Like any young love, however, it became a permanent part of my emotional inventory. Not that I actually knew very much about Jefferson's life or thought. My affinity for Jefferson was more personal than scholarly. Only once, when I was scouting about for a dissertation topic, did I consider working on Jefferson. My recollection is that C. Von Woodward, a fellow Southerner also recently arrived in New Haven, though as a mature and not just budding historian, alerted me to the dangers. One should not attempt biography until a bit further down the trail of life, he suggested. As for Jefferson, he was such a sprawling and famously elusive subject that any young historian who sailed forth after him was like the agile youth sent forward against impossible odds in a story about the tragic casualties of war. This excellent advice had the immediate sound of truth. I did not give Jefferson any serious scholarly consideration for another 25 years. As a college teacher, I assigned books about Jefferson in my courses, and I developed formal lectures on the Declaration of Independence and Jefferson's paradoxical stance on slavery. But it was not until I began research for a book on John Adams that I probed beneath the surface of the Jefferson correspondence. It was an odd way for a Virginian to come home again, arriving at Monticello by way of Quincy, but that is how it happened. Adams had a truly special relationship with Jefferson that developed out of their common cause against English imperial rule and their different roots in the regional cultures of New England and Virginia. As a result, Adams admired, even loved Jefferson. They sustained a 50-year friendship that culminated in an exchange of letters in their twilight years that most historians regard as the intellectual capstone to the achievements of the revolutionary generation. But Adams also disagreed profoundly with Jefferson's version of the American Revolution. Indeed, he thought that Jefferson's entire political vision rested on a seductive set of attractive illusions. The more I read, the more I concluded that Adams was right. For the first time, I began to see Jefferson critically and ironically. My clinching commitment to a book-length study of Jefferson came in the process of writing an essay for the inaugural issue of Civilization about Jefferson's somewhat problematic place in contemporary American culture. If my work on Adams had given me a new perspective, my essay for Civilization gave me a fresh appreciation of Jefferson's resonance as an American icon. One could work for several years on Adams and enjoy splendid isolation. But working on Jefferson was like entering a crowded room in which there were always several ongoing conversations, and the constant buzz suggested that more was at stake than the resolution of merely historical questions. Jefferson was electromagnetic. He symbolized the most cherished and most contested values in modern American culture. He was one of those dead white males who still mattered. These evolving thoughts became not just the reasons for writing a book about Jefferson, but also the decisive influences on the shape of the book itself. The vast literature on Jefferson has a decidedly hyperbolic character, as if one had to declare one's allegiance at the start for or against the godlike version of Jefferson depicted in Jean-Antoine Udo's marble bust or at least Rembrandt Peale's saintly portrait. This overdramatized atmosphere actually reproduces the polarized and highly politicized climate of opinion in Jefferson's own lifetime, when you were either with him or against him, loved him or hated him. True enough, most biographers take the sides of their subjects. But in Jefferson's case, the sides are more sharply drawn, and the choice is less negotiable. It seems impossible to steer an honorable course between idolatry and evisceration. That is precisely the course I have tried to pursue in the pages below, inspired by the example of John Adams, to believe that affection and criticism toward Jefferson are not mutually exclusive postures, rooted in the assumption that no authentically human creature who ever walked the earth could bear the mythological burden imposed on Jefferson, convinced in my own mind that youthful infatuations must go the way of youth, that all mature appraisals of mythical figures are destined to leave their most ardent admirers somewhat disappointed. The best and the worst of American history are inextricably tangled together in Jefferson, and anyone who confines his search to one side of the moral equation is destined to miss a significant portion of the story. My approach is selective. One early reader even called it cinematic, but maintains a traditional commitment to chronology. Another full-scale, multi-volume narrative of Jefferson's life and times is clearly unnecessary. My goal is to catch Jefferson at propitious moments in his life, to zoom in on his thoughts and actions during those extended moments, to focus on the values and convictions that reveal themselves in these specific historical contexts, all the while providing the reader with sufficient background on what has transpired between sightings to follow the outline of Jefferson's life from birth to death. This approach requires that choices be made all up and down the line, and I can only concur with the inevitable critics who conclude that the crucial years as Secretary of State or the exasperating experience of his second term as president cry out for fuller treatment. My only defense is to cite the extensive scholarship that already exists, to reaffirm my belief that Jefferson's story needs to fit between two covers and to admit my self-protective desire to avoid the fate of so many predecessors, a free fall into the Jeffersonian abyss. Our chief quarry, after all, is Jefferson's character, the animating principles that informed his public and private life, and made him the significant statesman and distinctive man he was. As I have found him, there really is a core of convictions and apprehensions at his center. Although he was endlessly elusive and extraordinarily adroit at covering his tracks, there were bedrock Jeffersonian values that determined the shape of the political vision he projected so successfully onto his world and that remained such a potent influence on ours. Moreover, again, as I have found him, Jefferson consistently and tenaciously sustained his allegiance to those core convictions from the time he first appeared on the national stage in 1775 until his exquisitely timed death on July 4, 1826. Jefferson's much-touted contradictions and inconsistencies were quite real, to be sure, but his psychological agility, his capacity to play hide-and-seek within himself, was a protective device he developed to prevent his truly radical and highly romantic personal vision from colliding with reality. As I try to show in Chapter 1, subsequent generations, including our own, have certainly discovered multiple meanings in the Jeffersonian vision, which naturally lends itself to diverse interpretations. But Jefferson himself knew what he meant and meant what he believed. What I have tried to do is to recover that man and that meaning within the late 18th century context in which they congealed, and to do so in language that embraces the Jeffersonian belief in the intelligence of the common American. This means that the specialized language of scholarly discourse has been translated into ordinary English, and the resonant meanings of such loaded terms as republicanism, Whig, liberal, and political party have not been assumed to be self-evident. While I certainly hope my fellow scholars will read the book, and even find the interpretation fresh and the inevitable blunders few, the audience I had in my mind's eye was that larger congregation of ordinary people with a general but genuine interest in Thomas Jefferson. My scholarly debts conjure up comparisons with Jefferson's massive financial shortfall at the end, which I can only hope to repay in the currency of gratitude. All students of Jefferson owe an unpayable debt to the late Juma Malone and to Merrill D. Peterson, whose heroic efforts to tell the story of the man and his time start from different assumptions and therefore reach different conclusions from the story I try to tell here, but who have set the biographical standard against which all the rest of us must be judged. The late Julian P. Boyd and his editorial successors at the Papers of Thomas Jefferson Project at Princeton have sustained a similarly high standard for assembling the primary sources on which all our stories depend. Finally, the superb staff at the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation were unfailingly helpful during my several visits to Monticello. Indeed, a special note of thanks is owed to Daniel P. Jordan, director of the foundation, and Douglas Wilson, director of the International Center for Jefferson Studies, who not only put me up at Kenwood and arranged several public occasions at which I could share my work in progress, but also sustained the highest levels of civility and support, even as it became clear that God had not given me the grace to see Jefferson as they did. Individual draft chapters or chapter-sized chunks of the manuscript were read by Howard Adams, Joanne Freeman, Ann Lucas, Pauline Mayer, Lucia Stanton, and Mary Jo Salter. Most or all of the manuscript benefited from the criticism of Catherine Algor, Andrew Burstein, Eric McKittrick, Peter Onuff, Stephen Smith, and Douglas Wilson. The customary caveats apply, meaning that none of these generous colleagues should be held responsible for my interpretive prejudices. Coming to terms with Thomas Jefferson is an inherently argumentative process, and the quality of the advice I received accurately reflected the serious disagreements about his legacy. Special thanks is due to Stephen Smith, the editor of Civilization, who let me try out early versions of my argument in his magazine. The prologue here first appeared in Civilization's November-December 1994 issue, my discussion of Jefferson's drafting of the Declaration of Independence in the issue of June-July 1995. My interpretation of Jefferson and slavery in the issue for November-December 1996. My agent, Jerry McCauley, held my hand and took me to lunch at the appropriate moments. At Knopf, my editor, Ashbel Green, along with his assistant, Jennifer Bernstein, ushered the book along with civility and grace. The entire manuscript was handwritten, then transcribed onto a disc by Helen Canny, whose ability to decipher the slant of my scrawl approached pure art. My three children, Peter, Scott, and Alexander, developed a full repertoire of jokes about falling into the Jeffersonian abyss. My wife, Ellen, read each draft chapter as it dribbled out and invariably had stylistic suggestions that I could not afford to ignore. The dedication at the start is to the historian who, both personally and professionally, embodies the values that my own work strives to emulate. Prologue. Jeffersonian Surge, America, 1992-93. If Jefferson was wrong, America is wrong. If America is right, Jefferson was right. James Parton, 1874. You could reach into your pocket, pull out a nickel, and find him gazing into the middle distance. As my liberal friends noted, always looking left. You could go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and see full-length statues of him on the campus he designed, then travel a few miles up his mountaintop and visit his spirit and mansion at Monticello. As of 1993, you could follow the James River down to Williamsburg, a route he took many times as a young man, and see another full-length statue of him on the campus of the College of William and Mary, a recent gift from the college he founded to the college from which he graduated, there looking off to the right, as my conservative friends noted, apparently studying the comings and goings at the adjacent women's dormitory. You could head north out of the Tidewater region, past Civil War battle sites, Cold Harbor, Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg, where both Union and Confederate soldiers believed they fought in behalf of his legacy, and you could cross over the Potomac from Virginia to the District of Columbia and find him in his own memorial on the Tidal Basin, looking straight ahead in this rendition, with plaques on the marble walls around him, reproducing several of his most inspirational declarations of personal freedom. Or, if you shared his romance with the American West, you could catch him in his most mammoth and naturalistic version on Mount Rushmore. But these were all mere replicas. In November 1993, a reincarnated Thomas Jefferson promised to make a public appearance in the unlikely location of a large brick church in Worcester, Massachusetts. On this raw New England evening, an impersonator named Clay Jenkinson had come to portray the flesh-and-blood Jefferson alive among us in the late 20th century. My own sense was that 40 or 50 hardy souls would brave the weather and show up. This, after all, was a semi-scholarly affair, designed to recover Jefferson without much media hoopla or patriotic pageantry. As it turned out, however, about 400 enthusiastic New Englanders crowded into the church. Despite the long-standing regional suspicion of Southerners, especially Virginians, John Adams had said that in Virginia all geese are swans, the appearance of Jefferson was obviously a major attraction. The American Antiquarian Society hosted a dinner before the event. All the community leaders, including the superintendent of schools, the heads of local insurance and computing companies, and a small delegation from the Massachusetts legislature, seemed to have turned out. What's more, representatives from the Library of Congress and the National Endowment for the Humanities had flown in from Washington. Also present were two filmmaking groups. From Florentine Films came Camilla Rockwell, who told me that Ken Burns, of Civil War fame, was planning a major documentary on Jefferson for public television. And from the Jefferson Legacy Foundation came Bud Leeds and Chip Stokes, who had just announced a campaign to raise funds for a big-budget commercial film on Jefferson. From Leeds and Stokes, I first learned that another major film on Jefferson in Paris was already planned, starring Nick Nolte in the title role. Their entourage included an Iranian millionaire who said that he had fallen in love with Jefferson soon after escaping persecution by the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran, an experience that gave him unique access to Jefferson's genius in insisting upon the separation of church and state. It was during the dinner that the germ of the idea made its first appearance in my mind, initially in the form of a question. What was it about Jefferson? Granted, 1993 was the 250th anniversary of Jefferson's birth, so a momentary surge in his reputation was to be expected. But were there any other prominent figures from the American past who could generate this much contemporary interest? There were only two possible contenders, so it seemed to me, both of whom also occupied sacred space on the Mall in the nation's capital. The American version of Mount Olympus, There was George Washington, the father of our country, who had the largest monument to patriarchal achievement in the world, dwarfing the memorials to the other American icons. Then there was Abraham Lincoln, who had a bigger memorial on the tidal basin than Jefferson, and was usually the winner whenever pollsters tried to rate the greatest American presidents. But Washington usually lost out to Jefferson. He seemed too distant and silent. There were no words etched on the walls of the Washington Monument. He was the Delphic oracle who never spoke, more like an Old Testament Jehovah, who would never come down to earth as Jefferson was doing tonight. Lincoln was a more formidable contender. Like Jefferson, he was accessible and had also spoken magic words. Ordinary citizens tended to know about the Gettysburg Address nearly as much as the Declaration of Independence. But Lincoln's magic was more somber and burdened. He was a martyr, and his magic had a tragic dimension. Jefferson was light, inspiring, optimistic. Although Lincoln was more respected, Jefferson was more loved. These were my thoughts as we walked across the street to the church where Jenkinson was scheduled to recreate Jefferson. He appeared on the sanctuary steps in authentic 18th-century costume and began talking in measured cadences about his early days as a student at the College of William and Mary, his thoughts on the American Revolution, his love of French wine and French ideas, his achievements and frustrations as a political leader and president, his obsession with architecture and education, his elegiac correspondence with John Adams during the twilight years of his life, his bottomless sense of faith in America's prospects as the primal force for democracy in the world. Jenkinson obviously knew his Jefferson. As a historian familiar with the scholarly literature, I was aware of several tricky areas where a slight misstep could carry one down a hallway of half-truths, places where a little knowledge could lead one astray in a big way. But Jenkinson never faltered. He was giving us an elegantly disguised lecture on American history that drew deftly on the modern Jefferson scholarship. Two things he did not do were also impressive. He did not try to speak with a Southern or Virginian accent. He obviously realized that no one really knows how Jefferson talked or sounded, whether the accent was more Southern or English or some unique combination. So Jenkinson spoke American. He also did not pretend to be in the 18th century. His Jefferson had materialized in our world and our time. He could not be accused of committing the sin of presentism because he was not making any claims about being oblivious to the fact that it was now, not then. Indeed, most of the questions from the audience were about current affairs. What would you do about the health care problem, Mr. Jefferson? What do you think of President Clinton? Do you have any wisdom to offer on the Bosnian crisis? Would you have committed American troops to the Gulf War? Sprinkled into this mixture were several questions about American history and Jefferson's role in its making. Why did you never remarry? What did you mean by the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence? Why did you own slaves? This last question had a sharp edge, and Jenkinson handled it carefully. Slavery was a moral travesty, he said, an institution clearly at odds with the values of the American Revolution. He had tried his best to persuade his countrymen to end the slave trade and gradually end slavery itself, but he had failed. As for his own slaves, he had treated them benevolently, as the fellow human beings they were. He concluded with a question of his own. What else would you have wanted me to do? A follow-up question at this point could have ignited some intellectual fireworks, but no one asked it. The audience had not come to witness an argument, so much as to pay its respects to an icon. If Jefferson was America's Mona Lisa, they had come to see him smiling. Despite the obviously respectful mood, it still surprised me that no one asked the Sally question. My own experience as a college teacher suggested that most students could be counted on to know two things about Jefferson: that he had written the Declaration of Independence, and that he had been accused of an illicit affair with Sally Hemings, a mulatto slave at Monticello. This piece of scandal had first surfaced when Jefferson was president in 1802, and had subsequently affixed itself to his reputation like a tin can that rattled through the ages and pages of history. I subsequently learned that Jenkinson had a standard response to the Sally question, which was that the story had originated with a disappointed office seeker named James Callender, who had a long-standing reputation for scandal-mongering, true enough, and that Jefferson had denied the charge on one occasion, but otherwise refused to comment on it, also true. A few months after I saw him at Worcester, Jenkinson was the main attraction at a gala Jefferson celebration at the White House, where he won the hearts of the Clinton people by saying that Jefferson would dismiss the entire Whitewater investigation as absolutely nobody's business. Jenkinson's bravura performance that November night stuck in my mind, but what became an even more obsessive memory was the audience. Here in the heart of New England, surely Adams' country, Jefferson was their favorite founding father, indeed their all-time American hero. In its own way, their apparently unconditional love for Jefferson was every bit as mysterious as the enigmatic character of the man himself. Like a splendid sunset or a woman's beauty, it was simply there. Jefferson did not just get the benefit of every doubt. He seemed to provide a rallying point where ordinary Americans from different backgrounds could congregate to dispel the very possibility of doubt itself. In a sense, it had always been this way. Soon after his death in 1826, Jefferson became a touchstone for wildly divergent political movements that continued to compete for his name and the claim on his legacy. Southern secessionists cited him on behalf of states' rights. Northern abolitionists quoted his words in the Declaration of Independence against slavery. The so-called robber barons of the Gilded Age echoed his warnings against the encroaching powers of the federal government. Liberal reformers and radical populists referred to his strictures against corrupt businessmen and trumpeted his tributes to the superiority of agrarian values. In the Scopes trial, both William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow were sure that Jefferson agreed with their position on evolution. Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt both claimed him as their guide to the problems of the Great Depression. The chief chronicler of the multiple Jeffersonian legacy, Merrill Peterson, gave it the name Protean, which provided a respectably classical sound to what some critics described as Jefferson's disarming ideological promiscuity. He was America's everyman. But at least until the New Deal era of Franklin Roosevelt, there were critics. The main storyline of American history, in fact, cast Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton in the lead roles of a dramatic contest between the forces of democracy, or liberalism, and the forces of aristocracy, or conservatism. While this formulation had the suspiciously melodramatic odor of a political soap opera, it also had the advantage of reducing the bedeviling complexities of American history to a comprehensible scheme. It was the people against the elites, the West against the East, agrarians against industrialists, Democrats against Republicans. Jefferson was only one side of the American political dialogue, often the privileged side, to be sure, the voice of the many holding forth against the few. To repeat, this version of American history always had the semi-fictional quality of an imposed plot line. The very categories were Jeffersonian and therefore prejudicial. But it ceased making any sense at all by the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt invoked Hamiltonian methods, i.e. government intervention, to achieve Jeffersonian goals, i.e. economic equality. After the New Deal, most historians abandoned the Jefferson-Hamilton distinction altogether, and most politicians stopped yearning for a Jefferson utopia free of government influence. No serious scholar any longer believed that the Jeffersonian belief in a minimalist federal government was relevant in an urban, industrialized American society. The disintegration of the old categories meant the demise of Jefferson as the symbolic leader of liberal partisans fighting valiantly against the entrenched elites. What happened next defined the new paradigm for the Jefferson image and set the stage for the phenomenon I witnessed in that Worcester church. Jefferson ceased to function as the liberal half of the American political dialogue and became instead the presiding presence who transcended all political conflicts and parties. As Peterson put it, the disintegration of the Jeffersonian philosophy of government heralded the ultimate canonization of Jefferson. The moment of Jefferson's ascent into the American version of political heaven can be dated precisely, April 13, 1943, the day that Franklin Roosevelt dedicated the Jefferson Memorial on the Tidal Basin. "Today, in the midst of a great war for freedom," Roosevelt declared, "we dedicate a shrine to freedom." Jefferson was now an American saint, our apostle of freedom, as Roosevelt put it. He concluded by quoting the words inscribed around the inside of the Jefferson Memorial's dome. "For I have sworn on the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Jefferson was no longer just an essential ingredient in the American political tradition. He was the essence itself, a kind of free-floating icon who hovered over the American political scene like one of those dirigibles cruising above a crowded football stadium, flashing words of inspiration to both teams. The more I thought about it, the clearer it seemed to me that the audience at Worcester offered a nice illustration of what we might call grassroots Jeffersonianism. Scholars and biographers of Jefferson seldom pay much attention to this phenomenon, since it has almost nothing to do with who the historical Jefferson really was, and the mental process at work, at least on the face of it, appears to resemble a blend of mindless hero worship and political fundamentalism. But it seemed to me that lots of ordinary Americans carried around expectations and assumptions about what Jefferson symbolized that were infinitely more powerful than any set of historical facts. America's greatest historians and Jefferson scholars could labor for decades to produce the most authoritative and sophisticated studies. Several had done precisely that, and they would still bounce off the popular image of Jefferson without making a dent. This was the Jefferson magic. But how did the magic work? The obvious place to look was the shrine on the Tidal Basin. According to the National Park Service, about 1 million visitors pay their respects to Jefferson in his memorial each year. On the March day in 1993 that I visited, several hundred tourists walked up the marble steps, then proceeded to spend a few minutes studying the dignified statue of Jefferson and snapping pictures. Then most of them looked up to the 4 inscribed panels on the walls and read the words, often moving their lips and murmuring the famous phrases to themselves. The first panel, which attracted more attention than the others, contained the most famous and familiar words in American history. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Actually, these are not quite the words Jefferson composed in June 1776. Before editorial changes were made by the Continental Congress, Jefferson's early draft made it even clearer that his intention was to express a spiritual vision. "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, that all men are created equal and independent, that from that equal creation they derive rights inherent and unalienable, among which are the preservation of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness." These are the core articles of faith in the American Creed. Jefferson's authorship of these words is the core of his seductive appeal across the ages, his central claim on posterity's affection. What, then, do they mean? How do they make magic? Merely to ask the question is to risk being accused of some combination of treason and sacrilege. Since self-evident truths are not meant to be analyzed, that is what being self-evident is all about. But when these words are stripped of the patriotic haze, read straight away and literally, two monumental claims are being made here. The explicit claim is that the individual is the sovereign unit in society. His natural state is freedom from and equality with all other individuals. This is the natural order of things. The implicit claim is that all restrictions on this natural order are immoral transgressions, violations of what God intended. Individuals liberated from such restrictions will interact with their fellows in a harmonious scheme requiring no external discipline and producing maximum human happiness. This is a wildly idealistic message, the kind of good news simply too good to be true. It is, truth be told, a recipe for anarchy. Any national government that seriously attempted to operate in accord with these principles would be committing suicide. But of course, the words were not intended to serve as an operational political blueprint. Jefferson was not a profound political thinker. He was, however, an utterly brilliant political rhetorician and visionary. The genius of his vision is to propose that our deepest yearnings for personal freedom are, in fact, attainable. The genius of his rhetoric is to articulate irreconcilable human urges at a sufficiently abstract level to mask their mutual exclusiveness. Jefferson guards the American creed at this inspirational level, which is inherently immune to scholarly skepticism, and a place where ordinary Americans can congregate to speak the magic words together. The Jeffersonian magic works because we permit it to function at a rarefied region where real-life choices do not have to be made. And so, for example, in that Worcester church, or in the hallowed space of the Jefferson Memorial, American citizens can come together in Jefferson's presence and simultaneously embrace the following propositions: that abortion is a woman's right, and that an unborn child cannot be killed; that health care and a clean environment for all Americans are natural rights; and that the federal bureaucracies and taxes required to implement medical and environmental programs violate individual independence; that women and blacks must not be denied their rights as citizens, and that affirmative action programs violate the principle of equality. The primal source of Jefferson's modern-day appeal is that he provides the sacred space, not really common ground, but more a mid-air location floating above all the political battle lines, where all Americans can come together and, at least for that moment, become a chorus instead of a cacophony. As a practicing professional historian who had recently decided to make Jefferson his next scholarly project, I found this a rather disconcerting insight, full of ominous implications. Jefferson was not like most other historical figures, dead, forgotten, and nonchalantly entrusted to historians who presumably serve as the gravekeepers for those buried memories no one really cares about anymore. Jefferson had risen from the dead, or rather, the myth of Jefferson had taken on a life of its own. Lots of Americans cared deeply about the meaning of his memory. He had become the great sphinx of American history, the enigmatic and elusive touchstone for the most cherished convictions and contested truths in American culture. It was as if a pathologist, just about to begin an autopsy, had discovered that the body on the operating table was still breathing. Not just any man can become every man. During the preceding 5 years, while I was working on a book about the life and thought of John Adams, only a few scholarly friends ever asked me what I was doing or, one surprised, felt any urge to follow up with inquiries that indicated Adams touched their lives in any way. The most common response from my non-academic friends was that they knew the Adams face because it appeared on their favorite beer, but they were mistaking John for his cousin Sam. Working on Jefferson, on the other hand, was like entering an electromagnetic field where lots of friends and neighbors, businessmen, secretaries, journalists, janitors, already resonated with excitement. When my furnace stopped working in the dead of the winter, the local repairman noticed the books of Jefferson piled up in my study. As I held the flashlight for him in the basement while he lay on his back replacing worn-out parts of the heat pump, he talked for a full hour about how critics had maligned Jefferson as an atheist. The repairman was a devout Christian and had read somewhere about Jefferson's keen interest in the Bible. No, sir, Jefferson was a good Christian gentleman, and he hoped I would get that right in my book. A neighbor who taught in the local high school, upon learning that I was working on Jefferson, promised to send me a book that he had found extremely helpful in distilling the Jeffersonian message for his students. A package then arrived in the mail that contained three copies of Revolution Song, which was not written but assembled by one Jim Strupp in order to provide young people with a contemporary look into the beliefs, ideals, and radical thought of Thomas Jefferson. The blurb on the cover went on, "In our country today, true democratic government is betrayed at all levels. As democracies emerge around the world, they are also subtly being destroyed." The hyperventilating tone of Revolution Song was reminiscent of those full-page newspaper ads in which Asian gurus or self-proclaimed prophets lay out their 12-step programs to avert the looming apocalypse. Actually, the propagandistic model for Revolution Song was even more provocative. This little book attempts to serve as a democratic alternative to the works of Chairman Mao and other non-democratic leaders. It was designed as a succinct catechism of Jeffersonian thought, a little blue book to counter Mao's little red book. No matter that Mao was in disgrace, even in China, and that communism since 1989 was an ideological lost cause, loitering on the world stage only as an object lesson in political and economic catastrophe, the global battle for the souls of humankind was never ending, and Jefferson remained the inspirational source, the chosen beacon of the chosen people, still throwing out its light from Monticello, his own personal city on a hill. Silly stuff, to be sure, but another example of how hauntingly powerful Jefferson's legacy remained at the popular level. Soon after I had received my complimentary copies of Revolutionary Song, another piece of mail arrived from someone also exploring the Jefferson Trail. The letter came from Paris, and the sender was Mary Jo Salter, a good friend who also happened to be one of America's most respected poets. She and her husband, the writer, Brad Lighthouser, were spending a sabbatical year in Paris, where Mary Jo was continuing to perform her duties as poetry editor of the New Republic and completing a volume of new poems. The longest poem in the collection, it turned out, would focus on the ubiquitous Mr. Jefferson. Although she explained that 98% of the facts and 92% of the interpretations historians can provide about Jefferson will never get into my poem at all, Mary Jo wondered if I might help with the history, explaining that it would be a crime to get my substantive facts wrong if one can possibly avoid it. For a poet of Mary Jo's stature and sensibility, Jefferson was certainly not a political choice, at least in the customary sense of the term. She had no ideological axes to grind, no patriotic hymns to sing. And it made no sense to think that propagandists and poets were plugged into the same cultural grid, which had its main power source buried beneath the mountains around Monticello. So I asked her, "Why Jefferson?" That question provoked a spirited exchange of letters over several months. Part of Jefferson's poetic appeal, it turned out, was his lifelong concern with language. He had also been the subject of several distinguished poets of the past, Robert Frost, Ezra Pound, and Robert Penn Warren had taken him on. But mostly, Mary Jo explained, poets are seized by images, and in Jefferson's case, two specific incidents struck her as poetic occasions. The first was his death on July 4, 1826, 50 years to the day after the acceptance of the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress, and the same day John Adams died. The second was another eerie coincidence, his purchase of a thermometer on July 4, 1776, and his recording a peak temperature of 76 degrees Fahrenheit that special day. These were poignant and eminently visual events, she explained, that captured a poet's imagination. They were the kinds of historical facts that poets usually were required to invent. Whether it was a certain knack or sheer fate, Jefferson's life possessed the stuff of poetry. The 30-page poem that Mary Jo eventually produced, entitled The Hand of Thomas Jefferson, was a meditation on the hand that wrote the Declaration of Independence, was broken in Paris during a romantic frolic with Maria Causeway, then crafted those elegiac last letters to Adams, and finally reached across the ages to pull us toward him. When I asked what about Jefferson pulled her, Mary Jo said it was his accessible mysteriousness, the fact that there appeared to be a seductive bundle of personae or selves inside Jefferson that did not talk to one another, but could and did talk to us. This was a bit different from Peterson's Protean Jefferson, which suggested a multidimensional Renaissance man. Mary Jo's Jefferson was more like postmodern man, a series of disjointed identities that beckoned to our contemporary sense of incoherence and that could be made whole only in our imagination, the place where poets live. I was not sure where that left historians, who were not, to be sure, obliged to disavow the use of their imaginations, but were duty-bound to keep them on a tight tether tied to the available evidence. Watching Mary Jo work made me wonder whether Jefferson's enigmatic character might not require the imaginative leeway provided by fiction or poetry to leap across those interior gaps of silence for which he was so famous. Did that mean that any historian who took on Jefferson needed to apply for a poetic license? It was absolutely clear to me that the apparently bottomless and unconditional love for Jefferson at the grassroots level was virtually impervious to historical argument or evidence. It even seemed possible that the quest for the historical Jefferson, like the quest for the historical Jesus, was an inherently futile exercise. No less a source than Merrill Peterson, the best Jefferson biographer alive, seemed to endorse such doubts when he made what he called the mortifying confession that after over 30 years of work, Jefferson remains for me finally an impenetrable man. Anyone who paused too long to contemplate the wisdom of the quest was likely to be trampled by the crowds who harbored no doubts. Upward of 600,000 Jefferson lovers were attracted to a major exhibit on The Worlds of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello, which ran from April to December 1993. Susan Stein, Monticello's curator of art, had made a heroic effort to reassemble most of the furnishings that had been dispersed starting in 1827, when Jefferson's crushing debts forced his descendants to auction off the estate. The result was a faithful replication of what Monticello's interior spaces actually looked like during Jefferson's lifetime. If the rooms of the mansion were in any reliable sense an accurate reflection of his many-chambered personality, they suggested wildly extravagant clutter and a principle of selection guided only by a luxuriously idiosyncratic temperament. Udo busts next to Indian headdresses, mahogany tables brimming over with multiple sets of porcelain and silver candlesticks, wall-to-wall portraits and prints and damask hangings and full-length gilt-framed mirrors. Perhaps all our lives would look just as random and jumbled if our most precious material possessions, gathered over a lifetime, were reassembled in one place. By any measure, however, Chock-a-Block Monticello resembled a trophy case belonging to one of America's most self-indulgent and wildly eclectic collectors. How did one square this massive treasure trove of expensive collectibles with a life at least nominally committed to agrarian simplicity and Ciceronian austerity? The exhibit suggested that Jefferson lived in a crowded museum filled with the kinds of expensive objects one normally associates with a late 19th century robber baron, whose exorbitant wealth permitted him to indulge all his acquisitive instincts. The one discernible reminder of Jefferson's preference for what he called Republican simplicity was the most valued item in the exhibit, the portable writing desk on which he had composed the Declaration of Independence. It was on loan from the Smithsonian, where it had resided since 1880, and the only other time it had been permitted to travel was in 1943, when Franklin Roosevelt took it with him the day he dedicated the Jefferson Memorial. The Smithsonian recognized that the writing desk was a sacred relic of American history and insisted on posting a 24-hour guard during the month it was on loan to Monticello, in part because of the sacred desk, the only private dwelling in America to attract more visitors than Monticello that year was Elvis Presley's Graceland. The phenomenon deserved a name or title, so I began to call it the Jeffersonian Surge. Nothing like it had accompanied the 250th birthday of George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, or John Adams. Nor had Lincoln's 150th birthday generated anything like this popular outpouring. The Jeffersonian Surge was not a movement led or controlled by professional historians. Jefferson was part of the public domain, withdrawing power independent of his status in the academic world. The folks who ran publishing houses, 17 new books with Jefferson's name in the title appeared in 1993, the producers and directors of films, Florentine Films was now in production, and James Ivory and Ishmael Merchant had begun filming in Paris, as well as museum curators and foundation directors, all obviously regarded Jefferson as a sure thing. Compared with the belongings of all other historical figures, things Jeffersonian had a broad, deep, and diverse market. It was as if one had attended a 4th of July fireworks display, and instead of the usual rockets and sparklers, had borne witness to the detonation of a modest-sized nuclear bomb. Shockwaves from the surge had even been felt at the highest reaches of the national government. During the Democratic primary in the spring of 1992, candidate Bill Clinton had been accused of sexual impropriety by one Jennifer Flowers, who claimed they had enjoyed a lurid affair during his days as governor of Arkansas. This story provoked a flurry of newspaper and television reports on the sexual adventures of past presidents, primarily John Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt. Several stories also mentioned Jefferson's alleged affair with Sally Hemings. In the fall, just before the presidential election, the Atlantic Monthly put Jefferson on its cover and featured an essay entitled Thomas Jefferson and the Character Issue. The author of the essay was Douglas Wilson, a respected Jefferson scholar who had no previous record of dabbling in contemporary American politics. His main target was what he called presentism, the presumption that the past can be judged by the standards of the present. Wilson's main intent was to defend Jefferson's reputation from contamination by its association with Clinton's alleged womanizing. But the piece also cut in the other direction, toward the present, by pointing out that few scholars accepted the allegations of Jefferson's liaison with Black Sal, thereby suggesting that slanderous assaults on their character were, and always had been, an integral part of public life that national figures had to expect and endure. In that sense, Clinton could claim that, like Jefferson, he was just another victim of sensationalistic rumor-mongering. After Clinton won the election, word was leaked by his staff that the president-elect was reading a big new biography of Jefferson by Willard Stern Randall, which also took a dim view of the whole Sally Hemings business. As if this were not enough to seal the bond between Clinton and Jefferson, Clinton made a point of taking a televised tour of the mansion and then retracing Jefferson's steps from Monticello to Washington just prior to his own inauguration. In the academic world, the winds were gusting in a different direction. Not that scholars had ignored Jefferson, or consigned him to some second tier of historical significance. The number of scholarly books and articles focusing on Jefferson, or some aspect of his long life, continued to grow at a geometric rate. Two full volumes were required merely to list all the Jefferson scholarship, much of it coming in the last quarter century. The central scholarly project, the Papers of Thomas Jefferson, continued to emerge from Princeton University Press at the stately pace of one volume every 2 years or so. 25 volumes had appeared by 1993. Though at the current rate, no adult was likely to be alive when the editors ushered Jefferson off to the hereafter. The problem, then, was not lack of interest, so much as lack of consensus about what the man stood for and what his career had accomplished. The love affair that continued to flourish in the public domain had encountered some rough patches in the academic world. Indeed, in some scholarly precincts, it had turned quite sour. Once the symbol of all that was right with America, Jefferson had become the touchstone for much that was wrong. You could look back and, with the advantage of hindsight, locate the moment when the tide began to turn in the 1960s. In 1963, Leonard Levy published Jefferson and Civil Liberties, The Darker Side, which, as its title announced, found Jefferson's record as a liberal defender of minority rights less than inspiring, and his rhetoric about freedom of speech and freedom of the press often at odds with his actions. But an even bigger blow fell in 1968 with the publication of Winthrop Jordan's White Over Black, a magisterial reappraisal of race relations in early America, featuring a long section on Jefferson. While hardly a heavy-handed indictment of Jefferson, Jordan's book argued that racism had infiltrated the American soul very early in our history, and that Jefferson provided the most resonant illustration of the way deep-seated racist values were buried within the folds of the white man's personality. Jordan adopted an agnostic attitude toward the allegations of a sexual liaison with Sally Hemings, but, while not endorsing the Sally stories, depicted a Jefferson whose deepest feelings toward blacks had their origins in primal urges that, like the sex drive, came from deep within his subconscious. Many other scholarly books soon took up related themes, but White Over Black set the terms of the debate about the centrality of race and slavery in any appraisal of Jefferson. Once that became a chief measure of Jefferson's character, his stock was fated to fall in the scholarly world. Another symptom of imminent decline, again, all this in retrospect, was an essay in 1970 by Eric McKittrick, reviewing the recent biographies of Jefferson by Duma Malone and Merrill Peterson. McKittrick had the temerity to ask whether it might not be time to declare a moratorium on the celebratory approach toward Jefferson. McKittrick asked, "What about those traits of character that aren't heroic from any angle, traits that went beyond the obvious complicity with slavery? What about his very un-Churchillian performance as governor of Virginia during the American Revolution, when he failed to mobilize the militia and had to flee Monticello on horseback ahead of the marauding British army? What about the fiasco of his American embargo of 1807, when he clung to the illusion that economic sanctions would keep us out of war even after it was abundantly clear that they only devastated the American economy?" From the perspective at Charlottesville, these were impertinent, if not downright hostile, questions. Duma Malone, the quintessential grand old man of Jefferson scholarship, had toiled for most of his long life, much of that time on the campus of the University of Virginia, to create his authoritative 6-volume biography, Jefferson and His Time, one of the great labors of love in American scholarship. Merrill Peterson's scholarly renderings of Jefferson were only slightly less heroic. Now, McKittrick was saying, that the insights available from the Charlottesville perspective, what he called the view from Jefferson's camp, had just about exhausted their explanatory power. Rather amazingly, it was in Charlottesville that the scholarly reappraisal of Jefferson that McKittrick had called for reached a crescendo. It happened in October 1992, when the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation convened a conference under the apparently reverential rubric Jeffersonian Legacies. The result was a spirited exchange, one reporter called it an intellectual free-for-all, that went on for 6 days. The conference spawned a collection of 15 essays published in record time by the University Press of Virginia, an hour-long videotape of the proceedings shown on public television, and a series of newspaper stories in the Richmond Papers and the Washington Post. Advertised as the scholarly version of a birthday party, Jefferson's 250th was coming up in April, the conference assumed the character of a public trial, with Jefferson cast in the role of defendant. The chief argument for the prosecution came from Paul Finkelman, a historian then teaching at Virginia Tech, and the chief charge was hypocrisy. Because he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, said Finkelman, the test of Jefferson's position on slavery is not whether he was better than the worst of his generation, but whether he was the leader of the best. The answer had the clear ring of an indictment. Jefferson fails the test. According to Finkelman, Jefferson was an out-and-out racist, who rejected even the possibility that blacks and whites could ever live together on an equal basis. Moreover, his several attempts to end the slave trade or restrict the expansion of slavery beyond the South were half-hearted, as was his contemplation of a program of gradual emancipation. His beloved Monticello and personal extravagances were possible only because of slave labor. Finkelman thought it was misguided. Worse, it was positively sickening to celebrate Jefferson as the father of freedom. If Finkelman was the chief prosecutor, the star witness for the prosecution was Robert Cooley, a middle-aged black man who claimed to be a direct descendant of Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Cooley stood up in the audience during a question-and-answer session to offer himself as living proof that the story of Jefferson's liaison with Sally Hemings was true. No matter what the scholarly experts had concluded, there were several generations of African Americans living in Ohio and Illinois who knew they had Jefferson's blood in their veins. Scholars could talk till doomsday about the absence of hard evidence or documentation. But the evidence did not exist for a good reason. We couldn't write back then, Cooley explained. We were slaves. And Jefferson's white children had probably destroyed all written records of the relationship soon after his death. Cooley essentially pitted the oral tradition of the black community against the written tradition of the scholarly world. His version of history might not have had the hard evidence on its side, but it clearly had the political leverage. When he sat down, the applause from the audience rang throughout the auditorium. The Washington Post reporter covering the conference caught the mood. Jefferson's defenders are on the defensive. What tough times these are for icons. Actually, neither Finkelman's sledgehammer blows nor Cooley's dramatic personal testimony were accurate reflections of the conference as a whole, though press accounts tended to focus on these presentations because they were the most colorful and controversial occasions. A more balanced assessment of the current state of Jeffersonian scholarship came from Peter Onuf, the successor to Merrill Peterson, as Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation professor at the University of Virginia and the chief organizer of the Charlottesville Conference. In an article entitled The Scholars Jefferson, published in the October 1993 issue of the William & Mary Quarterly, the leading scholarly journal in the field, Onuf suggested that Jefferson's stock was definitely going down, but that only a few historians were willing to follow Finkelman all the way and transform Jefferson from the ultimate American hero to the ultimate American villain. Scholars were not quite ready to raise the Jefferson Memorial or chip his face off Mount Rushmore. On the other hand, the mindless devotion to the mythical Jefferson that still dominated the popular culture clearly drove serious students of Jefferson to the